This is Indie Book Publishing. Indie Book Publishing is a show about new books and the authors who wrote them. It's an opportunity for prospective readers to hear directly from the writers, to hear what inspired them to write and publish, and to hear all the inside details about their books. And now, Indie Book Publishing.
The title of the book, Death of the Queen of Hearts, and the author, Roman A. Clay. And Roman joins us now on Indie Book Publishing, and this interview is brought to you by Archway Publishing. Hello, Roman.
Good morning, Steve. Thanks for inviting me here.
Well, great to have you with us, Roman. Death of the Queen of Hearts. You kind of set the stage with just one line. You say, a young European prince must uncover the truth about his mother's mysterious death in an automobile collision. Well, that's the general idea of the story. Before we get into behind the scenes, and as someone said, the rest of the story, I think that was Paul Harvey. tell us a little bit about your background and the real genesis of this great story.
I work in healthcare, because I have a regular job. This is my first book. And I remember one Labor Day Sunday waking up in 1997 and hearing that Princess Diana had died. And I was, shocked like everybody else. It was like a member of the family had died. And, I kind of let it go at that. But some books started appearing in England, nonfiction books that talked about what happened to her. So I read those books and I began to realize, the whole story wasn't being revealed. So I decided to write something up on it, and I did some research, in fact, a lot of research, and I wrote it up as a screenplay for a movie. And it was, it was difficult to get it made, and I felt the idea was too good to let go, so I just converted it to a novel.
So we're talking about Prince James, his mother, Princess Christina. She dies 4 years earlier in this suspicious car crash. Tell us this. What happens at this 21st birthday celebration where he starts to find out things he didn't know?
Right. He goes to his 21st birthday party. His mother had died 4 years earlier, and he receives this gift. One of the gifts was a letter, and written on the letter was the name Bunny, and it was a nickname that only his mother knew and used. So he says, well, who brought this letter? And nobody had brought it, so he opens it up. It's a reservation for dinner that night at a restaurant. So he immediately leaves the party, goes to the restaurant, and waits there. And then this mysterious stranger comes up behind him saying, don't turn around or I'll leave and you'll never see me. And Prince James says, what's this all about? How'd you know about Bunny? And he says, under the table. So James reaches under the table and finds taped underneath there a DVD. So when he gets home, he puts the DVD on and his mother appears. And she goes, happy birthday, darling. But I know that if you're watching this, something dire must have happened to me. And I want you to know, no matter what they say, whether they say it was an overdose, an accident, don't believe them. It was murder. And that starts him off on the quest to find out the truth on what really happened to his mother.
So in writing this book of fiction, this novel, you're trying to open up everyone's mind to other possibilities.
Well, I was surprised. When I would talk to people about what happened to Diana, most people thought she died in the tunnel. But that isn't true. When they first got to her, she was talking, she was lucid, and she could maintain a conversation. What had happened to her was the delay in getting her to the ER. So in Death of the Queen of Hearts, I really want to tell, give an idea of what really happened that night. Even though the entire book is fiction, at least the recapitulation of what happened to her that night, that is based on a lot of the research that I did.
So in your book, Prince James is heir to the throne.
Yes, he's the next in line to the throne after his father his grandmother, who's the queen.
So the death of his mother, there may be some perilous journey here for him.
He realizes what he's embarking on this journey, that he may uncover some dark truth, but he's open-minded. He wants to find out what really happened, and he's very, very dedicated to making sure that he has hard evidence on what really happened. So he starts investigating. He gathers some allies, and he embarks on this epic quest in the book Death of the Queen of Hearts.
So what are some of the other characters that are prominent in this story?
Probably the most prominent one, in the book, there is a woman, there is an author who, anonymous, who wrote a book on Princess Christina's death that opened up a lot of questions about it. So he tracks down this author, and it turns out to be this Asian woman, actually. And they join forces to really start to uncover what really happened. I think that's the other characters would be, you know, they're a friend of his who owns a bookstore who's involved. And there's his security guards who are sometimes good, sometimes bad. And his butler, of course, warden. And those are a lot of the characters in this book.
Sounds like somewhat of a conspiracy here.
Well, you know, in terms of conspiracy, I'd rather use the word planning for nefarious reasons.
Okay.
You know.
Planning for nefarious reasons?
Mm-hmm. Because, you know, there are quite a few reasons on why Princess Christina was killed. You know, I think I put them in the book. Her husband could not remarry and still become king if he were a divorcee, but he could if he were a widower. So that was one reason. I think another reason was they didn't want her to be the power behind the throne when her son, Prince James, becomes king, because you know, she had a different point of view than the royal family itself. And then the other reason, when Princess Christina dies, she was never autopsied. They went straight to embalming her. So it seems to indicate that maybe the rumors were true that she was pregnant. And they certainly didn't want the future King of England to have a half-brother who was probably of the Muslim faith.
So behind the scenes, who is trying to destroy, in the book, Prince James, of course, in real life, what you just mentioned. So there's this underlying theme that what seems to be the road to the throne, these people don't want that to happen.
They want a certain consistency. They don't want change. I mean, when you're in power, you're very, you know, you want to maintain things as they are. I think they felt that Princess Christina was a little bit too, I don't know, progressive, but she was open to change, and they didn't want that, I think.
You quote Albert Camus. Now, give us why you included that in a description of your book.
I just, it was an interesting quote for me, and I just put it in, and the quote is, fiction is the lie through which we tell the truth. And sometimes that's true. I mean, there are so many books that are written that are fiction, but they contain bits of the truth.
So from your point of view, from your research, from your background in the medical field, Diana could have lived, and so there was something a whole lot more to this, and maybe she was, there was a plan to murder her.
Well, I think the most salient point in what happened to Princess Christina and Princess Diana was the delay in getting her to the ER. In Death of the Queen of Hearts, you know, she died of a slow internal bleed to the pulmonary vein. If they had gotten her to the ER ASAP, and the ER at that time was only 3 miles away, she would be alive today. But they delayed her getting to the ER by almost 2 hours.
And no reason was ever given?
Not that I was able to determine. I mean, they kept her in the tunnel for 40 minutes. And then when they finally put her in the ambulance, the doctor on board the ambulance said, go 5 miles an hour. So there was an incredible delay. So by the time she had gotten to the ER, she had basically bled out.
So going 5 miles an hour wasn't standard procedure?
No. I think the argument there would be to, by going fast, it may destabilize her physically.
Right.
But I felt like the priority there would be to get her to the ER ASAP.
And no autopsy.
No autopsy was ever performed. They, like I said, they went straight to embalming her. And that's just, an autopsy is a legal requirement. And it was never done.
Well, as you write in your book, in that video, Princess Christina says to her son, Prince James, who she calls Bunny, "I have arranged for you to receive this when you turn 21. Remember, trust no one. Remember me. Avenge me."
Right. You know, when some people read that, it's really, well, I'll be honest, I basically took that idea from Hamlet. It's basically the opening act in Hamlet. So, you know, when you write a book, it's a subjective form. It's open to interpretation by everybody. So people will see different things. You know, they'll see what they want to see in Death of the Queen of Hearts. So like I said, that opening, thanks to William Shakespeare, I did kind of like use his opening to Hamlet.
Well, sounds like a good one to use.
if you're going to borrow, you're going to borrow from the best.
That's exactly right. Exactly right. And he dwelt on the imperfections of humanity, the human nature of us all. So you may know the real story here.
Well, I don't presume to know know what happened. I have no evidence. Like I said, I did some research. A lot of questions came up, and I think even Prince James in the book says there's too many unanswered questions about what happened to my mother. And I tried to address some of them in the book, Death of the Queen of Hearts.
We've been listening to Roman A. Clay. He's the author of his book, Death of the Queen of Hearts. Roman, what's the best way to get your book?
Of course, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and you can also order it from Archway Publishing. But I should just let people know, you know, it's a print on demand book. So when you do order it, it may take a little, you know, a week or so to get it because they get the order and then they print it up.
Thank you so much, Roman, for joining us on Indie Book Publishing.
Thank you very much, Steve. I appreciate it.
And this interview has been brought to you by Archway Publishing.
You're listening to Indie Book Publishing. And we'll be right back after these messages. Congratulations on being the proud owner of an adorable, soft, cuddly, sweet-smelling, smiling, cooing, hungry, tired, gassy, screaming little bundle of joy. So now what? Where's the owner's manual for this thing? Where are my instructions? Right here. It's Baby and Toddler Instructions with Blythe Lipman on toginet.com. Infant care specialist Blythe Lipman has worked with babies for over 20 years and works extensively with new parents, providing workshops, in-home visits, tips, and daily phone calls to ease those frazzled nerves. With Baby and Toddler Instructions, you can get the advice you need on how to survive and enjoy your baby's first year. For more information on Blythe and how she can help you, go to babyinstructions.com. From 32 ways to stop a baby from crying to 14 ways to get a baby to eat and so much more. It's Baby and Toddler Instructions with Blythe Lipman on toginet.com. Welcome back to Indie Book Publishing, helping authors publish, promote, and sell their books around the world.
Greetings for Indie Book Publishing, Westbow Press. This is J. Douglas Barker. The book has an important topic title, Hospice, the Last Responder. And joining me from the Houston area in Texas in the United States, Ellen J. Windham. Welcome to the program, Ellen.
Thank you so much. An honor to be here.
This is an important subject on a number of levels. First of all, my family has experienced caregiving for aging parents and that type of thing. Share with my listeners a little of your background and how you became interested in hospice and why it is something that you feel is vital to share.
I became hospice actually through a very special patient I took care of before I became a hospice nurse. A friend of mine in the Galveston area. And he actually died the night that I was there. And I thought, it was such an awesome privilege to be with someone as they take their last breath and their first breath into the presence of Christ. So I went back to school and actually became a nurse working just in the hospice industry.
The hospice industry is unique in that, at least for the primary family members, they get to experience some of the transition pains, I guess, that could be related to hospice. But not all hospice is an end-of-life thing, is it?
Yes, it actually is. It's not immediate. It's not an immediate end-of-life.
Okay.
The criteria for hospice is that the two physicians have to certify that the patient has 6 months or less to live in their opinion. Now, that's the physician's opinion, and it's based on the rules that Medicare in the United States set. Many patients live longer than 6 months because, as we all know, God is in control of how long we are here. So in that case, a person is recertified and can hospice longer and benefit from the services, and that's what we want them to be able to benefit from the services for as long as possible.
You have 208 pages, and it's not just anecdotal history of your being involved in hospice care, but it also has some good research behind it that anyone can benefit from. Who do you think is going to find your book most appealing?
I think that's my hope and prayer, is that every family member or every patient or every friend that has someone that is told by the physicians they need hospice care will benefit from this book. That was my whole purpose in writing it, is that in a concise, condensed way, they know the questions to interview a hospice, what to ask and what to expect from the hospice. There's so often when the doctor comes in and says, there's nothing more we can do, we need to call hospice, that the family members and the patient both are overwhelmed with, they don't know what to do. This book will guide them through that. And not only through everything they have available from hospice, but through the celebration of life, through a bucket list, how to do a bucket list, how to pick a funeral home, and how to know the funeral rules that the Federal Trade Commission has set forth for funeral homes to follow. And I can tell you myself, I did not even know about the funeral rule until I began writing this book and researching that part of it also.
You have
so all of that is in there.
You've mentioned something else that I found fascinating or of interest. 71 countries in the world also deal with the term or the idea of hospice. I was not aware of that. I figured it might be simply a North American idea.
Yes, there are 71 countries currently that deal with hospice care. Actually, hospice began in the European countries. And I put a timeline in the book to try to help people understand that's where hospice began, was with a European country, and then it moved to America in 1974. So it's really not that old in the United States. Hospice began back in the biblical times. It's a place for travelers and that were ill for someone to take in.
Hmm.
So the concept began back in the biblical time, but the movement began in the European countries and spread to the United States.
And up through the 1970s, and which is still part of, I think, the process today, families often took on that responsibility solely until there was some outside help in the 70s.
Yes, either that or they were in a hospital.
Yes.
And they were to tubes, and they had to deal with things. The patient had to deal with things. The family members did, that they didn't, that wasn't their wishes. There are a lot of times as we get older, quality of life is more important than the quantity of years that we spend on this earth. Because as Christians, we know we're going home, that we're just passing through here. And
so you have
many times.
You have a faith element in your book, obviously, from what you've described. The other thing that I think is certainly a topic of discussion worldwide and especially in Europe. When a person becomes ill, there is a concern, at least in Europe, or at least an option of checking out early. The Hippocratic Oath, how does that equate, or how does it attach itself to hospice care in the United States?
That is one of the largest reasons, the biggest reasons I wanted to write this book. I've seen so many, I began to witness so many so many states in the United States too, that have physician-assisted suicide. Mm. There are, and as I put in the book, there are two sides to every issue, and we know that. This is a time that there's not two sides to every issue. Not about physician-assisted suicide. Hospice is about caring for that family member for as long as possible and for them to be at home with family as comfortable as possible. But we want them to be home and comfortable. We don't want them or to take that journey home until God says it's time.
Mm-hmm.
And with physician-assisted suicide, you don't have that choice. That physician in I believe it's Oregon, Vermont, and Washington, the voters have voted on that in those states.
Wow.
And they're still trying to get more states to pass it.
That's incredible. I wasn't aware it was in the United States already.
Yes, it's in the United States. It's called the Death with Dignity Act.
Hmm.
And that act goes completely against what we believe in hospice.
You have included a lot of photographs and also some diagrams and sketches and even some templates for making lists, such as like my bucket list and my assistant. How does that work for someone that will buy your book? What do you think they'll learn from that?
I think that they'll learn that not just their family member or friend that's on hospice care, you want them to make a bucket list. It's like everyone needs to make a bucket list because we don't know. We don't know how long we're going to be here. And I think that we should, especially someone who's given a diagnosis of 6 months or less to live in the doctor's opinion, should be able to make a bucket list. And the idea of the bucket, okay, that's, and the shovel, that's the assist, those are the family member and, or the friend and the person that's helping them, the main person. So, to make a bucket list and decide everything you want to do.
While they're still lucid and able to communicate.
Exactly, while they can still communicate.
You've also included an adult wish organization compendium or listing of those organizations that, what would you find in those organizations that will help someone?
I was not aware that we had those organizations in hospice as long as I've been here. Working almost 16 years. That adult wish organization came from a lady I took care of last year. The two of us talked about a Make-A-Wish program
mm-hmm.
for adults
mm-hmm.
that are diagnosed with a terminal illness. All she wanted was for her granddaughter to meet one of our famous Houston Texan football players.
Really?
And in the book I stated that she told me that her granddaughter made as much money as he did, which is quite a lot because he's like one of the major defensive players for the Houston Texans. And she just wanted her to meet him. And so we had the social worker from the hospice working on that. And it was, she went home, she died and went to heaven before that came to pass because we didn't know right away. So I started researching and found that we have adult wish programs out there that can grant wishes to adults because we have so many for children. I thought that is such a great idea that an adult can have a last wish.
You have mentioned several very fascinating topics in your book. Among them that caught my attention was estranged family members, how to deal with that. understanding intimacy for the aging dying patient. That one is a curiosity for me. Pre-planning the funeral with the loved ones, medical terminology, and DNR, which is one that comes up in doctor's offices quite frequently when you're dealing with elder patients. What does DNR represent?
The DNR is a do not resuscitate order, and it is something where the family that goes on hospice care needs to have, if that's their wish. If that is the patient or the loved one's wish, then the DNR has to be posted in the home so that if emergency personnel are called, will not do CPR on that person and try to bring them back.
Nothing out of the ordinary. Is there anything in your book on a personal level that you feel is something that is going to stick with the reader, maybe a personal event that transpired?
I think possibly the estranged family member, because I dealt with that myself last April, actually. And as I mentioned in the book, my sister I had not seen for 4 years.
Mm.
And I went to see her, and Tim and I went to see her. And we did that because God told us to do it. We just felt in our heart that we should go. And when I chart, I knew how sick she was. And when I saw her, I knew how sick she was. So I really didn't remember anything of the past, and I just brought her home. And she lived 2 weeks. And about the bucket list, I asked her, I said, you know, would you like to do? What would you like? Respect your bucket list. And she said, my bucket list is filled. I'm home with you.
Beautiful.
And so,
that story of reconciliation is very important. What do you hope to accomplish from your book? And describe the ideal reader for what you have included in your book, Hospice, The Last Responder.
The biggest thing I hope to accomplish is that people have a better understanding of hospice care. If they understand that hospice nurses and doctors will go anywhere to care for a patient or a family member, that they will go there to care, not kill.
Hmm.
And I would like the healthcare workers all over the world to understand that is what we do. It seems like in hospice care, because people are so afraid of the stigma attached to it, possibly because of the physician-assisted suicide that's going on around the world right now.
Right.
That they just don't understand that we don't kill patients. We are there to make sure those patients are symptom-free, that they are comfortable and hopefully awake, because the medications, if they could understand that every person that signs up for a hospice care has an interdisciplinary team, and that team consists of a doctor, social worker, nurse, case manager, team manager, chaplain. The whole team works together, and the whole team meets every week on every single patient they have. And they go through every symptom that patient is having that week, because the symptoms do change day by day or week by week. And that everyone is right on guard with those patients to make sure that they're comfortable. But we want them to spend as much quality time as they can with their family. We don't want to take 1 second away from that person.
Beautifully put. Beautifully put. The title of the book again is Hospice, The Last Responder. My guest has been author Ellen J. Windham. Ellen, you've included in here insight into Medicare in the United States and how that works and several other important topics. Where do my listeners get a copy of Hospice, The Last Responder?
They can get a copy of the book from Westbow Press. And I also have a website. It's www.hospicethelastresponder.com. It's available on ebook, softcover, and hardcover.
Excellent. And they can also order it from their local retailer, book retailer, if they choose to, by asking for it under the name of the book, Hospice, The Last Responder. And for anyone that has a senior family member that might be going through health crisis or may be destined for that, this is an important book for you to read. And regardless of your age, I think you'd find it not only informative, but also instructional in many, many areas. Thank you again, Ellen, for joining me today.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. For Indie Book Publishing, West Bow Press, this is J. Douglas Barker.
You're listening to Indie Book Publishing, and we'll be right back after these messages.
Ever wonder if you're the only woman who runs errands in her yoga pants so it will look like she went to the gym? Or how about the only mom who feeds her kids raw cookie dough? Or are you the only one who cooks her family cold cereal for dinner? Do you need more laughter and less loudness? More self-love and less self-loathing? More joy and less judgment? You're not alone. Come to the living room. A place where we get comfy, candid, and confident together. Come seeking sanctuary and leave feeling renewed. We're saving a seat for you. Give yourself some living room today.
Welcome back to Indie Book Publishing, helping authors publish, promote, and sell their books around the world.
Greetings for Indie Book Publishing, Lulu Press. This is J. Douglas Barker. The book today is titled The 3-Year Affair. And joining me from Ontario, Canada, in North Bay, Ontario, which today is a cold day in Canada, is author Annie Omus. Thank you for joining me today.
It's great to be here.
This is a fascinating book of 144 pages. I say fascinating primarily because of the cover. The cover is certainly interesting, and some might call it provocative. You have a young lady with a beautiful tattoo and a wonderful color facing north. Share with my listeners the title, The 3-Year Affair. What was the motivation behind that, and how did you come to write it?
Well, actually, when I first started writing the book, I didn't really have any intentions of sharing it. I had a few of my close friends that are avid readers read it, and based on their suggestion, I decided to share it. I always kind of wrote for myself, and at the time, my post-traumatic stress disorder was in full swing, and it really helped me deal with a lot of those issues I was facing, and it helped me feel confident to make some serious changes in my life and be honest with myself and others. It forced me really to figure out what path I wanted to continue on with, and writing and publishing seemed to be it.
You mentioned PTSD. Was that military related, or was it something else?
It was something else.
Okay, won't ask you the details on that, but those are tough things to deal with. I think I have post-birth disorder, but I'm trying to work through that, and after about 80 years, I should be getting better at it. Your book should appeal to whom? Do you think this is a book that is, some people describe books like this as chick flicks or chicklets or other nomenclature. How would you describe the book?
The book itself should appeal to a large group of readers. I did do a focus group made up of people from all walks of life, men and women from ages of 15 all the way up to 87. And the one consistent thing that occurred through with the feedback was that it kept you reading from the beginning to end. And the description that was given to me was a female version of Sons of Anarchy, which I enjoyed. I think it's because it's not just a romance. It touches on a lot of different social issues, touches on bullying, spousal abuse, subcultural differences, and PTSD.
Fabulous. You have a variety of subject matter that you have approached in this. How long did it take you, Annie, to complete your work?
6 days.
6 days? I'm sorry.
Yes.
I don't mean to sound shocked, but I have some authors that take 15 or 20 years to get something out of their system. Did you begin by writing an outline, or how did you approach this? Or was it just what I would call inspirational or cathartic?
I'd written the intro to begin with, and I from there decided I wanted to write a book. And I kind of did an outline, but I focused on certain areas of the book that really were passionate to me, and then kind of sewed it all together. I didn't write from chapter 1 to chapter 15. I think chapter 1 was probably my last chapter.
Really? In writing this, is it going to be a really serious read for someone? Would you call it entertaining? Would you call it action-packed? How would you describe it?
It's not, well, it's been categorized as a romance thriller and mystery. Actually, the Kirkus review that I'd had, they had stated that it was a romance with often grisly, it's not often grisly novel. It's not just a romance novel. It seems to be in the beginning, but then it twists and turns. It becomes more about understanding yourself and a self journey.
Interesting. This book, then, would you call it entertaining? Will someone really find it a satisfying read?
Yes, that's the feedback I've been getting, for sure. It's romantic, it's sexy, it's a thriller, and it's engrossing.
Where is the setting? Where is the setting for the novel?
Part of it takes place in Canada, Toronto and Northern Ontario, and then as well Winnipeg, Manitoba. But it also takes you on a journey to Africa, Malaysia, Asia, and Japan.
Incredible. And all this in 144 pages, you must be a very focused writer or author in order to accomplish that. Is there one scene that you think will stand out to the reader that will make this a memorable read that they'll never forget?
Well, I could share the intro with you. I may have to change a few words in it, though, so that we can air it.
Well, go ahead.
Okay. I could feel his breath on my neck between kisses as my back hit the wall in the otherwise unoccupied men's room. The intense feeling of panic and desire ran through my body all at once. We have to stop. They're going to realize if we're gone too long, I said between breaths. No, they won't. We'll be quick, he says, trying to keep my attention on the task at hand. Holy crap, I whispered as I tried to fight the urge to open his belt buckle that my fingers somehow had found. His hands traveled down my body, grabbing and pulling me into the swirling tornado of passion that has found my center of being. We have to stop. Not here. Not here. I say this time with fortitude. He leans his head on my neck and tries to control his breathing, his body pressed hard against mine. I can feel his excitement as he tries to gather himself. I run my fingers up the back of his neck and through his thick, dark hair, trying to catch my breath as well. Okay, but this is far from over, he whispers in my ear. He leans down and kisses me. I try for a second one. He grins a seductive smile and pulls away, teasing me, making me want him more. Then after what feels like forever, he leans in for the final kiss of the session. I go weak under his control, and in that moment, I know I am screwed.
Well, that gets your attention. Your readership, is this an appealing book, do you think, for both male, female, and age? I guess there must be an age category that you feel might be appropriately enticed by this novel.
Yes, our main target audience right now are women between the ages of 25 and 50. That seems to be where our sales are landing. I'm hoping as well with the second book, which is going to be released February 14th of next year, The Guild, that we might pick up more of a male audience. The second one is a lot more violent and action-packed. It's got a lot of twists and turns and has been described as Quentin Tarantino-esque. So I'm hoping that we can pick up more of a male audience.
Is there a way that you would categorize your book maybe to describe it in a more profound or advanced way?
I think thriller and mystery romance is the best categories for it.
And what is your hope with this book? You mentioned you are doing a trilogy on this aspect of the novel. Is that also correct?
Yes. Like I said, The Guild will be released February 14th, and we're hoping to have the third and final chapter, Redemption, finished and out by Christmas of next year.
That's an ambitious task. You have been very successful in getting this completed in a short turnaround. Were there challenges in getting it to print?
Yeah, actually, the biggest one was the production itself. Not only am I the author, but I'm a part owner of the publishing company Annealmus Publishing. It's been a huge learning curve. This industry is giant to jump into, and I don't assume that the learning curve will ever change, which is kind of exciting. We're hoping to have open calls for manuscripts at the end of 2016 once this trilogy is out. And the best thing about it is I've had a chance to work with a lot of really amazing people. I have a formatter, Atlanta Healy in North Bay. I have a graphic artist and photographer, Brian Bujo from Brian Bujo Photography in North Bay. And he's responsible for the cover shoot and all of my the cover work and all of my PR pictures for our media campaigns. We have a copy editor, William Larichelle in Toronto, and our very talented McLean tattoo artist, Kayla Backinson from Dead City Studios. And that's the tattoo that you see on the back of the lady on the cover. And we also have a silent partner and our shrewd editor-in-chief, Natasha McDonald.
So that is a real tattoo. That is an actual tattoo on the model on the front.
Yes, it is.
Amazing. Well, mm-hmm. It certainly is identifiable if you ever see her at the beach topless.
Well, it plays into the book. The tattoo is actually in the book. It describes a portion of what's happening with her. So,
your main character in this book, what is their name, and are they carried through to the trilogy?
I'm sorry, can you say again?
The main character, the name of the main character, are they carried through to the next in the series?
Yes, the story continues.
Continues.
It just picks up where it leaves off. And the second edition of this book, which is available now for sale, has a sneak peek to the guild at the end.
Very good. Thank you for joining me today. The title of the book, again, is The Three-Year Affair. Annie Olmos has been my guest. Now, where do we get copies of your book, those that want to read this or at least get a copy of the cover?
Currently, it's available online. You can get it through Lulu.com, Amazon, Indigo, Barnes & Noble, Nook, Kindle, and iBooks. And we are working right now in discussions with Indigo.ca to try and get the books into Coles and Chapters in Canada.
Excellent. Well, best of luck on the books in the future. Thank you for joining me today and sharing your story. And if you're doing a search online, the author's name again is Annie Olmos. That is spelled in a little unusual manner. Annie is spelled A-N-N-Y. Olmos is O-M-O-U-S. Do a search under that name, and you'll also find the other books when they're released. Thanks again.
Thank you. Have a good day.
My pleasure. For Indie Book Publishing, Lulu Press, this is J. Douglas Barker.
You've been listening to Indie Book Publishing with your host, Steve Jorgensen. Join us again next week at noon Eastern as Steve interviews another great author.